Hey, I'm Houston from Gulfport, Mississippi. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me. You should support the show like I did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's kind of hard to categorize my guest Shamir. He's known for dance music, but he used to sing country songs and he played in a punk band. He weighs about 120, and he's not exactly the kind of guy you'd picture throwing punches.
Oh, I will fight all the time. Like, all the time. Because people, you know, people will, like, try to try me. Like, I don't know, I guess, like, during puberty, I didn't really, like, you know, get facial hair and, like, my voice in deeper and whatever. So, obviously, you know, the boys with their raging hormones would, like, try to fight me or whatever. But I obviously didn't go down without a fight. And a lot of people didn't kind of, like, realize that I took taekwondo a few years before.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk to Shamir about what it was like to grow up in the Las Vegas suburbs and why his new record sounds the way it does.
I kind of decided to make my music more danceable and lighthearted to take away from the heaviness of the lyrics. Why does your music also have to be heavy if your lyrics are?
Then later, I'll sit down with Pete Rock. He's one of the greatest hip-hop producers of all time, a guy who can find and transform the perfect sample. It all started when he was a kid, listening to his dad's records.
As I got older and remembered, a lot of the music that I thought was great sounding, I would bring it to life in a hip-hop form.
Rock's new album, Pete's Strumentals 2, is out now. We'll talk about that, plus some exclusive showbiz gossip about Kanye West.
Kanye, man, he's a very nice cat. You know, you see what he goes through with the media and people judge him from that. But when you off the record with him, he's actually a nice dude.
That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. So it can be a little bit hard to describe Shamir if you don't know anything about Shamir. He says he prefers the pronoun he, but he doesn't really have a strong gender identification. His singing voice is a countertenor, high-pitched, but strong and rich and full, not like a Curtis Mayfield-ish falsetto. It's the sort of gender-defying voice you might hear from Nina Simone or a young Mavis Staples, only in reverse. He grew up in exurban North Las Vegas, down the street from a hog farm, which he says stunk up the whole town. He's black. It's tempting to connect his music to R&B and soul traditions, but he came to dance music through punk rock. In fact, maybe it's better to let Shamir's music do the talking. Here's On the Regular from his debut album, Ratchet.
Howdy, howdy, hi, hi. Well, everyone is minus, you could call me multiply. Just so you know, yes, yes, I'm that guy. You could give five fingers and I'm not waving high. Yes, I'm never ending, you could call me pie. But really, how long till the world realize? Yes, yes, I'm the best. What you heard, anything less is
obviously absurd.
Shamir's Twitter bio says, 20, musician, comedian, singer, rapper, twerker, chef, writer, filmmaker, skinny fat ass. Love me? Question mark, exclamation mark. Shamir, welcome to Bullseye. It is really great to have you on the show.
No, thank you for having me.
So I try to avoid this kind of cliched question, which is, why did you name a thing the name that you named it? But I am sincerely curious as to how you ended up naming your first record Ratchet.
Well, I like to, you know, represent where I come from as much as possible. That's why I named my first EP Northtown, which is the name of the suburb in Vegas where I'm from. And so Ratchet was just kind of like the natural next thing for me to name my album, because it's kind of like what me and my friends always called each other and kind of like describe each other as.
I have to say, like, when I think of Ratchet, well, first of all, I'm old. So when I think of Ratchet, I probably think of a socket wrench. Then maybe I think of a gun, which is what it used to mean. And it's sort of a synonym for what, when I was a teenager, used to be. It's sort of an epithet that means like ghetto or classless. you're not the picture that comes into my mind if I hear someone say that word.
We have our moments. We've kind of used it to as like a softer ghetto, where like we definitely like have our ghetto moments and do very ratchet things, but we still try to keep it as classy as possible.
Las Vegas is, you know, one of the great entertainment cities in the United States. It's probably one of the cities where the most people work in the entertainment industry. But it's a very weird version of the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you knew people who were professional musicians or entertainers in your life, like whether that seemed like a real thing.
In Vegas, a professional entertainer is that word to a T. You're an entertainer, and that's it. You're not an artist. And that's kind of like what Vegas lacks is artist. And there's not too many artists coming out of Vegas. Yeah, it's easy to kind of like, you know, get a cabaret gig or like a playing an instrument with a band on the strip or downtown or whatever. Like, those gigs are easy. But when you're an artist like me trying to make original content, that's where it's hard. And because there's not too many outlets for that.
I know you were in a sort of punkish duo before before you started making the music that you're making now, which is much dancier, as we heard.
Mm-hmm.
Did you think of yourself as punk?
I still do. I'm still like a little grungy punk rocket at heart. I mean, even still to this day, I don't even really listen to a lot of electronic or pop music. Pop and electronic music for me was kind of like an experiment, and it was something to help me get out of my comfort zone and also kind of like help expand my sound. And this just happened to kind of be the sound that kind of everybody like got a chance to catch on to, but you know, throughout the years, I've done country and punk and R&B and rap and all of that. So I just like to, like, challenge myself as a musician and look at genre as a tool as opposed to, like, a box to be put in and try to stay, like, in those confines. Like, I like to try out everything and challenge myself as a musician.
I want to play a little bit of one of the songs from your new album. This song is called Make a Scene, and my guest is Shamir.
Like guys who's ripped and buffing, guys like girls who have big butts, and girls are sad all of the time, because good guys are so hard to find. So why not go out and make a scene?
I think a lot of people who make dance music, especially electronic dance music, have a really specific test for whether something is good, whether they're going to put it out or not. And that is, you know, they print up a white label, they take it to a club, or I guess at this point they make an MP3 and send it to a club, and they go and see whether it fills the dance floor. And I wonder, you the way that you've described yourself in the past in interviews, like, I kind of wonder just, like, even if you're the kind of guy that likes to, like, hang out in a club and see if the dance floor fills. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I'm not. I just, like I said, I kind of use dance music as a tool to kind of lighten my lyrics. Like, what I am at most is a singer-songwriter. Like, that's what I am to the core. You know, most of my songs on the album, if you were to, you know, strip away all the backing tracks and give me a guitar, I'll be able to play them, because that's how a lot of the songs, you know, start off. I kind of decided to make my music more danceable and lighthearted to kind of like take away from the heaviness of the lyrics. Because, I mean, you know, why not? Like, why does your music also have to be heavy if your lyrics are, you know?
You mentioned that you used to make country music. And I know you were pretty serious about it, like you competed in talent competitions and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you make country music about country music themes, traditional country music themes, or even contemporary country music themes? And, like, did that make sense to you and, like, feel at home to you as a form?
Sometimes, like, listening to, like, traditional country music themes, I kind of, like, relate and feel it because, you know, North Las Vegas is still pretty small and everyone kind of knows everyone and, you know, it's centered around a farm and it's super, like, dusty and you literally get chased by tumbleweeds. So it's definitely that, like, back home feeling. But my songs were no different than what they are now. They were just kind of about life in a very honest way. I mean, even now on the album, a lot of the songs start off as country music. Call It Off is heavily influenced by a Jewel song. And Demon on the album started off like as an acoustic song that I wrote and played on guitar and just like sent it to my producer. And he turned it into, you know, the pop song that we know today.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of Demon from my guest, Shamir.
You took me over to the dark side. The thrill was good. Together we stood like a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. We were staying around. Forget the bad things we done. We were fit for survival. No books but the Bible held out with a gun.
Feeling when you are, when you're making, Anorexia is the punk duo that you were in previously. What's the difference in feeling when you are doing that in front of people and when you are singing dancey pop records that, you know, are making everyone dance in front of people?
When I was in Anorexia and when I would perform at Anorexia, we didn't care about if you were in tune. We didn't care about, like, how loud certain things was or whatever. We just kind of, like, it was just, like, very raw. And it was just, like, more just kind of, like, getting out angst and feelings across. Whereas when I play and perform now, I almost feel like I'm, like, channeling. I almost don't feel like myself on stage. It's almost like I'm gone for, like, an hour or however long I'm on stage. And then once I'm done, I come off and I feel like Shamir again in a weird way.
I've heard you describe yourself as like a pretty introverted person in real life.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Even a few weeks ago when I played the Music Hall Williamsburg in New York, and I didn't really sleep the night before. I had played 3 different sessions and was up at like 6 a.m. doing a meeting or something, and I didn't get any rest, so I completely lost my voice. And I was like super scared. I was like, this is a sold out show and like it's gonna be horrible. And I was like on vocal rest and everything, and before I hit stage I was like doing vocal warm ups with like my backup singer and everything, and it just wasn't looking too good. So I was like kind of like down, but it was just something about just like stepping on stage. Like as soon as I stepped on stage, like my voice was like completely back to normal. And it was just like, it's just like I wasn't even singing. It's just like something else took over. And I kind of like feel like that usually almost every time on stage. So it's not, it almost is like it's not even really me. Like, I don't know what happens. Like, I can never sing as good as I can on stage, like off stage. I don't know what happens.
I want to play a song from your new album that's called Darker. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about it before I play it.
The sample at the beginning of the song is from an old band from Austin called Scratch Acid. And I was just like listening to a lot of them and their song specifically, Owner's Lament. So I went home and did a little quick little loop of that song and just like looped it. And that's how I wrote the song, just singing it over that loop. And the song I originally wrote about when my great grandma died and how her death was not really seen as like a sad thing for me or a lot of my family, because she's in her 90s, she lived a grateful life, and it was just like kind of like a beautiful thing as opposed to just like a sad thing. And the song is just kind of like looking at death in a more positive light and kind of like thinking about and realizing that we don't die unless we're supposed to. Like everything kind of like happens for a reason, and we only die when we're done, you know, walking our paths.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Shamir's Darker. That refrain that it doesn't get darker unless you expect it to. How did that come to you?
It's a lot, like a lot of people, I guess, that don't believe like in the afterlife or whatever, just kind of like think that you die and that's it. And you're buried under a bunch of dark dirt and that's it. Like the light is on and then the light is out. And I definitely, at least my ideals, believe that the light isn't out. Depending on how you lived your life and what you did, the light just kind of gets brighter. My mom is very, very spiritual and very hippie, and she does what she calls earth magic and different things like that. So definitely some of her ideals rub off of me sometimes.
Does your mom ever do magic for you?
Yeah, but I don't like it. I don't like the magic part. I don't do that.
Have you told her?
Yeah, but she still like sprays me with like weird things and throw herbs on me or whatever. I mean, sometimes it works, but I'm like, no, mom.
I mean, it's kind of sweet, isn't it? What a nice mom thing to do magic for you. I mean, I'm sure if my mom knew how to do/believed in magic, it would be, she'd be all over doing some magic for me.
I mean, I rather just live out life. I definitely believe in like universal manifestation, but that's that's not like magic to me. It's just kind of like putting things out into the universe and kind of like, you know, really focusing on it, and things kind of like manifest. And I think definitely that's how things worked for me.
I'll continue my conversation with Shamir after a break. We'll talk about middle school gender identity, stand-up comedy, and fighting. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Take a listen to Alt Latino, a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order every week on Alt Latino from NPR Music at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Ty is a pedantic person. I think when he pronounces these words, it's in a very show-offy way. Gyro.
Yiro.
Sacre bleu.
Sacre bleu.
Ayers Rock.
Uluru.
What you are witnessing is real. The participants are not actors. They are actual litigants with real cases. They call in via Skype to Judge John Hodgman's court, the real people's court. Now I call you to Judge John Hodgman's internet court. Find it at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Shamir. His new album is called Ratchet. It blends his distinctive countertenor with infectious, joyful beats.
I watched a clip of you on the internet that was a submission for a stand-up comedy contest.
Yeah.
It was really charming. And your opening chunk was this story about being in, I want to say, middle school, and sort of asking a very innocent question about an art project and having the teacher take you aside afterwards to ask if you were having gender identity problems.
True story.
Yeah, I was going to say, it was real specific to not be a true story.
I mean, obviously, when you're in middle school and everyone is kind of transforming into their respectable, I guess, assigned genders, and you're not, you kind of feel a little, it was hard. It was a little left out, obviously. And I'm like, I'm not getting facial hair, and my voice is just not getting deeper. And, you know, my features are softening. Like, what is going on? You know, so I definitely, when I had asked that question, I was just kind of like being a class clown too. I was just like, well, can I use like squares? Because I feel like they're more like manlier, and everyone kind of like laughed. So like she, like, you know, made me stay after class. And she's like, are you having like gender like ID issues or whatever? Because I guess she felt that I was like maybe trans or something. I guess she kind of like thought that I was kind of like trying to make myself look more feminine. And I guess she didn't kind of like realize that I was just kind of going opposite of everyone else naturally in a weird way. But yeah, like she's like gonna like send me to the counselor and everything or whatever. I'm like, I'm fine. Like, it's not that big of a deal. I was just kind of like joking.
You left the punchline out of the story that you told in your stand-up act, which was you replying to her, well, I could drop my pants and you can identify my gender.
Yeah, JK. JK.
And the coda to that was, I ended up getting kicked out of that school, but it's okay. I didn't need to be in, that wasn't the right school for me anyway. Was that part true?
No, but I have been, you know, it was middle school, so I've been suspended a few times. I was actually almost going to go to what they call opportunity school, which is kind of like a reform school.
Right. Why did you get, so what did you get suspended for?
Oh, I will fight all the time. Like, all the time. Because people, you know, people will, like, try to try me. Like, I don't know, I guess, you know, I didn't, like, during puberty, I didn't really, like, you know, get facial hair and, like, my voice in deeper and whatever. So, obviously, you know, the boys with their raging hormones would, like, try to fight me or whatever. But, obviously didn't go down without a fight. And a lot of people didn't kind of like realize that I took Taekwondo a few years before.
So were you doing actual Taekwondo moves on dudes?
I've only lost one fight, and he was like three times my size.
Do you ever worry that something that came so quickly could go quickly?
I don't want to like sound like ungrateful or anything, but I really don't care. I've already like exceeded so much than I had planned for. When I first sent my demo out to God Mode, which is like a tape label, my only goal was to get like maybe 50 to 100 tapes done. I was super content with being a working musician, like a working, like a musician that still like works and just kind of like do music for fun. Like that was the goal. That was the plan. So I kind of feel like I'm in a mind where like I really have nothing to lose. I'm like super young. I have my whole life ahead of me and I can still always go back to school. I can still always get a job. Like it's not like my good years are over. I'm only 20.
Well, Shamir, I really loved your record, and it was really great to get to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on Bullseye. It was really fun.
No, thank you for having me.
Shamir's new album is called Ratchet. It's his second record. He also has an EP called Northtown. Besides that, he has just announced a bunch of tour dates crisscrossing the United States this fall. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Pete Rock grew up in a house full of records. His dad was a DJ on the side. By the time Pete was 17, he was spinning hip-hop on the radio and starting to make beats. In his early 20s, he was half of one of rap's great duos, Pete Rock and CL Smooth. Here he is with a rare vocal turn on one of the group's first records, The Creator, from 1991.
A dip, dive, dip. You might break your hip to the sound, that's legit. I come to make a hit. I usually bust scratches for my brother CL Smooth, but I decided to get wrecked on this groove. As I provide this slide, you're going on a ride. I know the weather's nice, there's no need to play the outside. Guess who's on the flyer? The man of your desire, Pete Rock and CL Smooth, all the honey dips admire. Beats are rough and rugged, Pete Rock is the creator. Now I'm busting raps as well, switching cross faders. Making sure my sound hits from here to Grenada. Honey gave me skins, man, I told her friends I ate her. Oh, waiter, I'll save the subject for later, but it's time to get wrecked with the creator.
In the decades since then, Rock's produced for artists like Kanye West and Nas, among many, many, many others. His new album, though, doesn't have any feature vocalist. It's called Pete-strumentals 2. Pete Rock, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Oh, man. Great to be here.
So tell me what kind of records were in your house when you were a kid.
Everything. Reggae, soul, jazz, classical. I mean, my pops probably had every genre of music.
What's the first music that you remember really loving?
James Brown. And when I was about 3 years old. And I used to listen to a lot of his 45s, you know, and a lot of his albums. And then when I became 7 years old, my mom took me and my younger brother to a concert he performed at right in our neighborhood, you know, and was blown away by it. And, you know, when I shook his hand, you know, I was never the same after that. It's like
did he
almost
say anything to you?
Yeah, he said, God bless me. And it's like he passed along something to me through the handshake, you know. That's probably why I am who I am today.
I mean, that's a pretty intense thing for a 7-year-old.
I don't even have words for the excitement that was going on the inside of me. You know what I mean?
Were you allowed to have records of your own?
Yeah. You know, I dibbled and dabbled in my dad's collection. He had so many. And then as I grew older, I kind of was, you know, swiping them from him to start my own collection. But, you know, he kind of was a proud dad when he found out what I was doing with him.
What's the first time you remember making a beat?
Probably like in high school. Yeah, in high school, probably about 10th or 11th grade. You know, that's when my cousin Heavy D became successful. That's around the time when I was learning how to make beats and, you know, being a fan of certain producers that were out there doing their thing, like Marley Marl and Teddy Riley and Howie T in the 80s, you know, where they had the rap music on lock, making hit records. And, you know, I was attracted to that and always was curious about the man behind the music, the man behind the boards, and wanted to be that man.
Was it the fact that your cousin had gotten a deal that, like, gave you enough insight to where, just to know where a beat came from?
Yeah, not a beat, actually, but where does my talent lie, he was more into. Like, he noticed that I had something, you know, and he was the one that said, you know what, you got something, man, let's bring that out of you. And, you know, from the beats I was making, they started out, like, as pause button beats. Like, I would, you know, keep pausing a certain part of the record that I liked and keep it going on time and on rhythm with the pause button. And, you know, made a lot of stuff like that and took some ideas. And Heavy D liked a lot of the stuff that I was doing by pause button. And we actually made it a reality on his second album called Big Time.
I want to play one of your early remixes, and especially early in your career, remixes were sort of a specialty of yours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a, you know, this track, both in its original version and in your remix, are all-time hip-hop classics.
Mm-hmm.
This is Public Enemy.
Oh, wow.
And my guest Pete Rock's remix of Shut 'Em Down. This was really early in your career. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe you guys had, you and CL Smooth had maybe put out your first EP, but not your first album.
Right.
Is that right?
That was right around the time that remix was made.
So you guys, you weren't exactly Mr. Famous at the time. And
no, I was. That one made me famous. That actually, that remix right there is the one that made me famous. It was, you know, Public Enemy was huge, you know, and here I am, just a DJ, you know, trying to get my feet wet in the music business. And everybody's rooting and cheering for me, you know, from the neighborhood, because they realized the talent that I had. And when I made that beat, it was right before a 4 o'clock session, and I left my house, you know, at 3, but I didn't really exactly leave. I went next door to make the beat, and it took me about 15 minutes, and then I left to go try to make it on time for 4 o'clock session. And, you know, the P.E. remix, to me, was very different from anything ever heard in hip-hop. So I'm just glad people took to it the way they did, you know, because it blew me away as well.
What was different about it?
Just the way it sounded, you know, with different elements of sounds in the one track. You know, you were getting a lot of melodic sounds, you know, when you listen to, as soon as the beat drops, you're hearing heavy drums, heavy bass line, horns, you know what I'm saying, that were interesting sounding. And, you know, and Chuck's demanding voice, you know what I'm saying? It was what brought the track over the mountain.
It's an interesting sound to me because it sounds so completely different from Public Enemy's sort of signature aesthetic and the beats that the Bomb Squad were making at
mm-hmm.
the time.
Mm-hmm. But I had big, huge respect for the Bomb Squad. I used to watch them work, and because I, you know, was in the same studio working that they were, you know, and I saw a lot of things go down that they were doing, from the Ice Cube album to their own stuff. So
it has some of the density of sound of the Bomb Squad, though. Like, that's, to my mind, like, one of the things that's most distinctive about those Public Enemy records
mm-hmm.
is they're, like, they're intense, but they're also really dense in a way that, like, you know, a record from a few years earlier that Marley Marl or somebody produced wasn't. And your beat there is kind of like a mix of that density and, you know, what we now think of as a you know, the classic New York, you know, boom bap sound or whatever.
Yeah.
But it has that same kind of incisiveness, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of my favorite remixes right there. You know what I mean? And that was before I didn't know that remixes didn't count. I just, you know, I was just doing them, you know, like crazy. Well, it was good for me to get my name out there, but, you know, you learn what counts and what doesn't.
I'm playing a lot of your music, Pete Rock. I want to play a record that doesn't have your name on the label, but probably will forever be associated with you.
Oh, okay.
It's a record from an album called The Honeysuckle Breeze, 1967. The artist is a guy who went on to be the band leader of the Chevy Chase show.
Wow.
And
Tom Scott
wrote the theme music from The Streets of San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And the song is called Today. Yeah. Let's hear a little bit.
That's one of my favorite jazz tunes right there.
When I hear that song, I do not think, oh, that sounds like it could make a dope beat.
Yeah, it's one of those songs that people can relate to because, you know, I dedicated it to a really special friend of mine who passed away. And when he passed, it just kind of shocked and rocked the neighborhood because he was well known in the neighborhood, and he lived on my block. You know, he lived on the same, we lived on the same block, couple houses away from each other. So we shared a lot with each other growing up in that neighborhood and on that block. So, you know, when he passed away, you know, I found a way to give something back to him that you know, came from our hearts.
When you were making the song that Tom Scott record became, which is the Pete Rock and CL Smooth song, They Reminisce Over You.
Mm-hmm.
Were you making that beat with the knowledge that you wanted to make a song about your friend Troy Dixon who died?
Yeah, I was in depressed mode. Until this day, I don't know how I picked that record and made the beat the way I made it. But when I was listening to the Tom Scott record, you know, I started to get emotional. I don't know, maybe I think that was a trigger or something for me to try something with that song. And, you know, I just dug deep into it, man, and you know, tried a few tricks with you know, bringing out certain sounds in the song and in the sample. And it worked out.
Let's listen to Pete Rock and CL Smooth and They Reminisce Over You.
Still ain't got the latest. Yeah. I strive to be live because I got no choice. And run my own business like my Aunt Joyce. Yeah. So Pete Rock hit me, enough respect to when they reminisce over you. Listen. Just listen to the funky song. As I got on, and as word is born, to the one and only. Never be another, he was my brother.
Pete, I've been to a lot of hip-hop shows in my time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times in between acts, a DJ will be spinning records.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not unusual to have a set that's, you know, what they now usually call golden age hip-hop, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like
Yeah.
And for some people, starts in the end of the 80s, but certainly, you know, the beginning of the 90s.
Yeah.
And that's a song that, you know, basically more than any other elicits a huge response from pretty much any crowd of hip-hop fans.
Wow. That's, you know, great. Yeah.
When that, you know, when that horn riff comes on.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me as I was preparing for this interview, mm-hmm. that it must be, I mean, it's a kind of a lovely thing, but it's also kind of an odd thing mm-hmm. to have this song that defines an era in hip hop mm-hmm. be for you, on the one hand, one of the greatest works that you ever created. On the other hand,
you know,
it's a really personal thing about your friend that died.
Yeah. Yeah, God was working with me when I was making that beat. Yeah, I could definitely say that because he knew how much we loved him, you know. So he definitely worked with me. Because that to me, still blows me away how the end result came out.
Does that roar of recognition, I mean, you and CL Smooth have toured over the years.
Mm-hmm.
When you've been together as a group, mm-hmm. Does that roar of recognition feel good to you, or does it feel a little bit weird and inappropriate because it's such a, you know, it's such a tragic thing in your life?
I used to be bothered by both feelings, but now I look at it and I celebrate Troy, man. You know what I'm saying? I celebrate him. Like, you know, he was a live person, so, you know, I kind of celebrate him a lot, you know what I mean? You know, so that's the feeling I get when I listen to this, you know. But when I first made it, the song made not only me emotional, but friends of mine that were in the studio while I was mixing it down, you know what I'm saying? Or crying, you know, at the listening to it, you know, at the, you know, mix down. I had Charlie Brown in there from the Leaders of the New School, and Busta Rhymes, and, you know, dudes was emotional, you know.
Was it weird when it would, like, come on the radio?
Nah, it wasn't weird. It was like celebration time. It was like, wow, I can't believe we're on the radio. I can't believe that my beat is on the radio. You know what I mean? Couldn't believe what I was hearing, you know. Like, in 91, when we put out our EP, they were playing The Creator a lot on the radio, you know, daytime, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, or, you know, 6 o'clock. We couldn't believe it.
I'll finish my conversation with Pete Rock after a break. He'll talk about finding the perfect sample and his part in what might be the greatest hip hop record ever, Nas's Illmatic. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Take a listen to Alt Latino, a weekly dive into the world of Latin alternative music and culture, featuring sounds like psychedelic tropical music from the jungles of Peru and Mexican folk rhythms mixed with electronica. Hear the Latino artists changing and challenging the established order every week on Alt Latino from NPR Music at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hi, I'm Julie Sabatier, host of Rendered. It's a show about making meaning and breaking rules. We're answering important questions like, can you build a spacesuit in your living room?
I went to my brother's place in Beaverton, and he has a swimming pool, and I pressurized the suit and sat down there underwater for about 10 minutes. The thing that I had built was supporting my life. That felt really good.
What does it sound like when you play a polka record through a styrofoam cup? And what happens when an airport carpet gains a cult following?
Oh my goodness, the carpet has an Instagram.
Check out Rendered now at MaximumFun.org or wherever you like to listen to podcasts.
I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on Bullseye is the producer and sometime rapper Pete Rock. He came up in the early 90s as part of the duo Pete Rock and CL Smooth, and he's produced for hip-hop legends like Kanye West, Nas, and Public Enemy. His new album is called Pete-strumentals 2. You alluded earlier to the kind of studio tricks that you brought to that Tom Scott record to make They Reminisce Over You.
Yeah.
That seems like one of your great contributions to hip-hop production is the creativity that you brought to using studio equipment to transform samples.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about that, you know, for an audience of people who maybe even have a hard time getting their head completely around a loop from a song becoming another song?
Well,
like what you do to...
You kind of have to have an ear for this kind of thing. You know, you have to start from a very young age listening to music that you can't forget, like something that it's embedded in your brain forever. Like if you hear a Jackson 5 song or a James Brown song or something that sounds very exciting, it's hard for you to... Well, it was hard for me to forget exciting music. So as I got older and remembered a lot of the music that I thought was great sounding, I would, bring it to life in a hip-hop form. And, you know, I always thought that was a way of showing my talent and making something that people are familiar with sound totally different. But, you know, flipping the sample around to make it sound different than just looping it or doing stuff like, you know, filtering the sound of a sample to where you only hear like the bass part of it, where it sounds just like a bass line.
A lot of hip hop is built out of breaks, right? Which is like
a
moment in a song where an instrument, often the drums, but not always the drums, essentially comes free and clear, you know, for dancing or whatever.
Well, the drums and, part of it was the most famous, part of the record where if it would give you an empty drum break, then there's your hip-hop sound, you know. And that's something that Kool Herc discovered, you know, and brought back from Jamaica, you know. And, listening to soul records and finding these breakbeats. You know, not only soul records, but rock records, too. You know, rock records had lots of drum breaks.
I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on Bullseye is the legendary hip-hop producer Pete Rock. His new album is called Pete'stramentals 2. I want to play a little bit of a song from Pete'stramentals 2, which is Pete Rock, my guest's new album. This song is called Dilla Bounce.
Yeah, Jay Dilla, rest in peace.
Jay Dilla was a hip-hop producer who died a few years ago, actually, I guess a little bit more than a few years ago now.
Yeah. Rest in peace. God rest his soul.
And he was someone who came from the generation after you. You know, he started to emerge in the late 1990s.
But very aware of you know, music. Like, very aware. He's from Detroit. He's from the Motown, you know, city of Motown. So that goes a long way, you know, with him, you know what I mean? With musicians from Detroit, period. I always thought they were the greatest musicians.
He was someone who, like you, one of his great contributions to hip hop was the way that he used studio equipment to transform samples, both in the way that he would reduce samples to their tiniest constituent parts, or the amazing ways that he could use a filter to isolate sounds.
Right. That's basically what I was doing early in the game. And when Dilla came along, he kind of re-inspired a lot of producers, including myself, and then just a new spark to producing. He was the new spark, like that you know, came out doing some incredible things that people couldn't understand what the heck he was doing. You know what I mean? But I did because I spent time with him. You know, when I first met him, I spent a week with him at his house and, you know, met his moms and, you know, told me that he wanted to be like me in the sense of being a hip hop beat maker, you know, and she said I was his favorite and, you know, things like that. And that made me, you know, smile and made me feel good. And, you know, I was like, wow, your son is great at what he does. You know what I mean? So
how did you end up at his house?
When I heard a beat tape that Q-Tip played me, you know, and we kind of talked on the phone and, you know, we were kind of like, you know, having a great conversation on the phone, and then told him I would come out there to visit, you know, to visit him because, you know, the beats that Tip played me blew my mind. And I'm like, wow, there's another guy out here making hot music, you know what I mean? To where, you know, I became a fan instantly.
So you literally, you like had a phone conversation with him and you loved his tape so much that you're like, hey, Jay, I'm on my way to your house to stay for a week.
Well, I basically said, hey, man, I would love to come visit. He actually invited me, you know. I didn't, you know, throw myself on him. You know what I mean? And he invited me. So I was like, oh, all right, I'll come out there. You know, and then we ended up working on music together. And, you know, I worked with Slum Village on their first album with him, doing a song called Once Upon a Time. You know, a couple of remixes we did. Some things that never came out we did. You know, it was just good old fun and us just being happy to be in each other's presence.
What impressed you most about the music that he made?
Everything. Things that, music that he was using that no one else was using. And a lot of the records that he was using were from the 80s. And, you know, he would use 70s stuff, but there was a whole new world of 80s samples that people weren't using and that he was using. And I'm talking about jazz records, you know. I'm talking about jazz records, you know, certain R&B soul records. But jazz, he was great. He was a great digger. Like, he was a great, you know, digger of records, like finding the illest stuff.
I'm sort of picturing you just sleeping on a bed in Jay Dilla's basement, and the bed is made out of
on a couch, pull-out bed.
Piles of albums.
Yeah.
Just everything is piles of albums.
Well, he had wall-to-wall records, and he had them in these nice bookshelves, and that's how I was able to, you know, find out about, you know, having, you know, bookshelves as record bins. So I would, you know, went to IKEA and, you know, decorated my house with bookshelves all over, you know, and putting records in them.
Did you know at the time that you were sort of his hero?
Not really. I think maybe in the 90s, you know, maybe like, you know, 91, 92, 93, and that around between those years there. In 94. Yeah, so like from 91 to 94. It could have been like, you know, the one, you know, I was, you know, I was, you know, just getting known then. You know, the music I was making, the remixes I was doing was making me famous.
I want to play a song you produced in 1994, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And, you know, it's one of the great tracks from what is very possibly the best hip-hop record ever recorded, Nas's Illmatic.
Of course.
This song's called The World Is Yours.
It's yours. Whose world is this?
The world is yours. The world is yours.
It's mine. Whose world is this?
It's yours.
It's mine. Whose world is this?
The world is yours.
the world is yours.
It's mine, it's mine, it's mine.
I sip the dark peat watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes. All the words past the margin. The whole of mic, I'm throbbing. Mechanical movement.
Understandable, smooth. The murderers move with.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, when you think that this was, you know, this was basically the first record. This is the first album he made. I mean, there was a couple guest appearances before that.
Yeah. Well, it helps.
And it
when
seems
you...
like everybody was just like, this is a special thing. We all need to get in on this.
Yep. And it was like, it helps when you make good beats, but then you have this extraordinary MC who can bring your music over the top just by his golden voice and how he raps over music, man. You know, and the lyrics, you know, he talks about real stuff, you know, things in our environment that we see, and you know, and making the youth aware of you know, going down a certain path in life and his experiences in life, you know, and teaching kids, hey, this is a better road to go down. I went down this road and experienced this, this, and this. But, you know, his album was like, I call it a scholar. I call his album Illmatic like a scholar. It's like, you know, to me, it taught a lot of people, and not only kids, but just, you know, people of age as well, you know, what it's like to live in an environment where you see certain things going on, you know, all the time. You know what I mean? And your chance to want to get out and live a better life. You know what I mean?
Did you feel like it was something special in the beginning? Like, did you go into the studio with him and think, this is something magical that I'm part of?
Yeah. Yeah. Automatically. Because my peers who produced alongside me with, you know, doing this Illmatic album, Q-Tip, Large Professor, myself, DJ Premier, and LES, you know, like, that's the starting Fab Five in hip-hop, you know, for an album that became huge and successful. And, you know, I'm just lucky and happy to be part of that, man, even if it's just one song that I did on there.
I want to play a more contemporary record that you produced. It's a song from the Watch the Throne album called The Joy.
Oh, okay. How insanity feel. Don C just had a shorty, so it's not that bad. But I still hear the ghosts of the kids I never had.
This was a record that got made in that period of time where it was just like Kanye West in a mansion in Hawaii with 20 other dudes hanging around.
Yeah,
just
nah.
Like, I'm going to make Kanye, the greatest album ever, no matter what it takes.
Yeah, Kanye, man, he's a very nice cat, man. You know, you see what he goes through with the media and people judge him from that. But when you know, off the record, you know, with him, he's actually a nice dude, you know what I'm saying? And knows his hip-hop. He's very knowledgeable of music. And, you know, told me he used to chop up my little beat interludes I would put between records on my albums. And, you know, that was fun working with him in Hawaii, of all places, and, you know, seeing black sand beaches and rainbows in broad daylight. Sun is beaming, and it's pouring raining.
I imagine it was kind of fun to be able to walk into a situation with a beat that was made out of like an entire Curtis Mayfield song.
Yeah, and that was one of my favorites.
And just know that, like, you can bring it in there, and like, if he wants to use it, they totally have the money to license an entire Curtis Mayfield song
and clear the sample, which we did.
Yeah,
and that's you know, to me in my eyes, that song is a winner because, you know, I had no clue Jay-Z was gonna jump on there. You know, I when we were doing the song, Jay-Z wasn't the option. You know what I'm saying? I thought it was just going to be Kanye rapping on it. You know what I'm saying? But then, you know, I received a phone call from an engineer friend of mine who played the final version for me over the phone, and it blew me away to hear Jay-Z on it. So I was like, wow. Because me and Jay-Z been trying to work with each other years before Kanye made the connection. So
you have kids, right?
Or two.
One kid?
Two.
Would you be happy for them to spend their life working in the music industry?
I can't say not the way the music industry is today, but I would always tell my kids, you know, I started out doing this thing as a hobby. I had no idea that one day it would turn into my career, you know. So the world is their oyster. I always tell them, you know, there's various things that you can do. They're very smart kids, and very proud of them, and I love them very much. And they have so many choices in life, what they want to do, you know. But my son loves music. My daughter loves music. He's into it. He loves my beats. You know, I get in the car with him and pop in a beat CD, and he's like, "Oh, Daddy, I like number 10, or I like number 6. Can you play number 4? That's my favorite." You know. So.
Well, Pete Rock, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
No problem, man.
Why don't we go out on one last song from Pete's Trumentals the new album from my guest, Pete Rock. And I was shut off. I Wish, from Pete Rock's new instrumental album, Pete's Trumentals 2. It's out now on Mellow Music. You can find more from him at PeteRock.com. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. So usually this is the part of the show where I recommend one thing, one movie, one album, one book, whatever. Right now, though, it's summer, and I am feeling profligate. So please, inflate one of those lounge chairs that floats in a pool. Crack a cold one. It's time for me, Jesse Thorne, and my all-time top 5 summer jams. Starting at number 5. There's only one greatest summer band ever. It's the Beach Boys. Anyone who tells you otherwise is a first-class chump. The problem is that their summer jam output is so huge, it's almost unnavigable. There are a million perfect summer jams in the Beach Boys catalog. It's kind of overwhelming. So, I say we go with the one that has a solo from a musical instrument called the tannerin. Good Vibrations.
I love the colorful clothes you wear. And the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me
okay, number 4. The greatest summer song is Summertime from Porgy and Bess, but as typically performed, it is not exactly a jam. I mean, Paul Robeson doesn't quite scream pool party.
Summertime, and the living is easy.
But luckily, there is one version of Summertime that is a jam. Billy Stewart, that's our number four.
A summertime, and the living is easy. Fish are jumping, don't you know, my darling? I said it right now, and the cotton is high. Like a your daddy is a rich, got a rich girl, and your mommy's good looking.
I feel like any summer jam list needs some light rock. Like, I don't know, Chicago's Saturday in the Park would be good, or Summer Breeze by Seals and Crofts, or The Boys of Summer by Don Henley, which it's got a little bit of melancholy, which is always a good summer song quality. But here's a tiebreaker that I made up for picking a light rock summer jam. Always go with the song that has a guy making a fart noise into a jug. Number three, In the Summertime by Mongo Jerry. If you're making a summer jam playlist, you want to have a kind of a contemporary pop record in there somewhere. I mean, not brand new, but something from the last 10 or 15 years. Katy Perry would be good. Beautiful by Snoop Dogg and Pharrell. Maybe a G-Funk barbecue record like Summertime in the LBC. But it seems to me like in this case, when we are picking one of those songs, we should go with the obvious greatest pop song of my adult life. Even though at no point do they actually say summer in it. Seriously, the only downside of this song that I'm about to roll out here is that your party might get too live when you play it. Anyway, take it away, Beyonce. And then number one, well, I mean, number one's easy. Summertime by DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. As we used to say in elementary school, doy.
Short set. Yeah, I got on sneaks, but I need a new pair. Cause basketball courts in the summer got girls there. The temperature's about 88. Hop in the water plug, just for old time's sake. Break to your crib, change your clothes once more. Cause you're invited to a barbecue to start at four. Sitting with your friends as y'all reminisce about the days growing up and the first person you kiss. And as I think back, makes me wonder how the smell from a grill can spark off nostalgia. All the kids playing out front, little boys messing around with the girls playing double dutch. While the DJ spinning a tune as the old folks dance at your family reunion. Then 6 o'clock rolls around, you just finished wiping your car down. It's time to cruise, so you go to the summertime hangout, it looks like a car show. Everybody come looking real fine, fresh from the barbershop, a fly from the beauty salon. Every moment frontin' and maxin', chillin' in the car, they spend all day waxin', leanin' to the side, but you can't speed through, 2 miles an hour, so everybody sees you. There's an air of love and of happiness, and this
okay, have a great summer, gang. That's my outshot. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Senior producer at Maximum Fun is Colin Anderson. Our new production fellow is Ibarianex Perello. Welcome, Ibarianex. All our interstitial music provided to us by Dan Wally. Thanks to the Go Team and their label Memphis Industries for our theme music. Thanks this week to Neil Rauch and Manoli Wetherill at NPR in New York for their engineering help. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, you can for free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear about more cool culture stuff, check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It is a roundtable discussion of everything that's great in popular culture, hosted by the brilliant and hilarious comedian Guy Branum. This week, this is a big one, folks. This week, Guy declares his official Summer Jam 2015. His whole life has been leading up to this, or at least the last month or so. Plus, what do you do with pop culture that no longer seems appropriate? Was TV Land right to pull repeats of the Dukes of Hazzard? Pop Rocket. It's free. It's available wherever you get podcasts. Search for it. Subscribe to it. It's so great. Very proud of it. Cool show. Okay. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.